What I thought to do is, in our sessions, maybe a few, each week, a few verses of the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, just to go through them, because you're chanting it out loud after lunch, you know, every fourth day. And it's also very good to have an understanding of this text. His Holiness often teaches this text before he gives initiations. And also, when you're doing the retreat, it's so incredibly important for you to do longer meditation. And this text contains the fundamental longer meditation. So that's just a few verses each week just to talk about. Because I can't emphasize enough how important it is during the retreat to do Lam Rim. Okay? Because you're purifying, but what's really going to change your mind and really going to help you do things differently in the future is changing how you think, changing how you look at the world. And so it's the Lam Rim meditations that are going to help you do that. Because those are the meditations that are going to shift the way you conceive of yourself and the way you conceive of the world. Okay, just saying mantra, just doing visualization alone will not necessarily do that. Okay, because, for example, to really shift, first of all, what we need to be able to do is discriminate what is a constructive thought, a constructive motivation, a positive mental state, and what is a destructive thought or a destructive mental state. And if we can't do that, you know, if because in our ignorance sometimes we aren't clear what's positive and what's negative in terms of karma or in terms of our mental states or our behavior. If we can't do that, then it's going to be very difficult to purify and it's going to be very difficult to change. Because there's no clarity in the mind about what we want to change from and what we want to change to. Okay? So you need the help of the Lam Rim to help you, you know, recognize these mental states. And then we need the Lam Rim meditations to actually show us a different way of looking at things. Okay? And so that's why, you know, I just can't emphasize enough really doing that. Because you'll see that it's the whole Lam Rim outlook, the whole Buddhist worldview that creates a very deep shift within us. And unless that shift occurs, we might visualize up and down, you know, the mountain and recite gazillions of mantras, but we're still going to look at life in the same old way. With me, center of the universe, everything I apprehend is permanent. Yeah, pleasure is what I experience by my center, by my senses, and there's a real me and everybody else and real everything out there. Okay, and unless we start to change some of those viewpoints and realize what cyclic existence is and what it means to be caught in cyclic existence and how we really want happiness, but what we're doing is the opposite to happiness. You know, and that it's our mind that's causing the problem, not the external objects in people. Until we can really get a handle on that and really shift how we look at life, you know, not a lot's going to change. Okay? I suspect as you're going through and purifying now, are you noticing a little bit of your old worldview? Not your old worldview, I mean just what your worldview is, how you look at things. Yeah? Are you noticing some habits in your mind? Yeah? Are you noticing different perspectives? You know, how, for example, we think that whatever happens to us is never going to change. Okay? If it's pleasurable, we think it's never going to change or it never should change. And if it's painful, like our knee hurts in the session, then also that's never going to change, is it? You know? And so we just look at that view that doesn't even recognize things like this change and how much confusion it causes in our life. you know, let alone the view that we're going to last forever, you know, and that death happens to other people, but not us. Yeah? I mean, do you really feel like you're going to die? Well, you say that, but, you know, that happens to other people. Okay? So these kinds of views, you know, or just the view is probably coming up a lot in your meditation, all these things that you wanted to have in life that you couldn't get. Is that coming up? No? You're not sitting there dreaming about the perfect relationship that you always wish you had, but the person never turned up? Okay? Or the perfect job you always wish you had, but it never kind of happened? Or the, you know, the perfect house you really wanted to live in, but it never came about? Really? What are you getting distracted about then?
I've been going back to grateful. I've been having people coming up in my meditations that aren't having fun
years ago. Of course, yeah, they come up in and you haven't thought about them in 40 years, and what's your reaction to them?
Well, I play out the relationship that I have with them, whether they were a friend of mine or somebody that I didn't like. So I kind of played over the old story.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I catch myself, oh, that's kind of odd. Why is this person coming up in your meditation right now? That's when I realize I've tried to run up against my mind and it gets bored. My mind mm-hmm. gets frustrated because I'm not farther along in the meditation than I should be. I get entertained by my past.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, when those people come up from the past and you're going through them and you're replaying the relationship, isn't your mind kind of wishing it would have been different? Some aspects of it? Different? Wouldn't it have been nice? Yeah, this didn't happen, this didn't happen, this didn't happen. Wouldn't it have been nice? Maybe the relationship could have turned out like that. Now, how nice it would be if we had kept in touch all these years. Or, you know, so this is what I'm talking about. Okay? Yeah? It's the mind is taking something and wanting it to be other than it was. You know, the old friendship, oh yeah, it was really wonderful, but gee, it would have been so nice if it had continued, or it would have been so nice if we didn't have that fight, you know, and that person could have continued being a really good friend and da-da-da. You know? Okay? So this is what I'm getting at. Yeah, that the mind is still looking out there in the people and experiences we had in the past, and evaluating our the happiness as if it came from those people and those circumstances, and then wishing that we could have tweaked the past. You know, couldn't we tweak the past? It couldn't have been tweaked when it was. Tweak me if I change it a little bit, you know, when it was happening, so it would be better now, so we would have a better memory in our meditation. I mean, this person comes up and it's such a bad memory. Why couldn't it be a good memory? Okay, so this is, yeah, the mind that's still seeing happiness out there, you know, and wanting even our memories to conform. to be good memories, or to take what happened in the past and let's, you know, replay it again now, but it's going to be different and it's going to be better, you know, with a different person in a different situation or something like that. But the mind state behind it is pleasure exists in the people and objects out there. Okay? And so if I can succeed in arranging them all properly, then I'll have the happiness that I want. Yeah? Is there that view in your meditation? If there's not that view, then I'm not sure. Either you should be teaching the course or you should be looking harder in your meditation. But, you know, for most of us, it's, I mean, this is what's coming up. Yeah? Is how can I make things outside be the way I want them to be so that I'll be happy? Yeah? Okay. okay? And so, like you said, things will come up, you know, from 40 years ago. I mentioned to you before, I realized when I did Bodhisattva, I was still mad at my second grade teacher because she didn't let me be in the class play. You know, I'd forgotten it for I don't know how many years, but I remembered it in Vajrasattva. Yeah? Okay. And then you start to see, okay, well, how many times in my life have I been felt that I deserve something, but they didn't give it to me? You know? In second grade, I deserved to be in the play, and they didn't give it to me. How many other times? Oh, yeah, a lot in my life I'm playing this out. If I deserve something, and the world's not giving it to me. Okay? So we start to look at these old patterns of how we interpret things, of what data we select in the environment to pull out and make a story about and interpret in one way or another. Okay? Because people can look at the same situation. You know, you didn't get to be in your second grade play, class play. One person could look at it and go, whoa, am I really glad, because I'm so shy, and if I had been in front of all those people, I would have been nervous and made a fool of myself. And that would have been maybe their pattern, their whole life, always trying to exit right so that they don't make a fool out of themselves because they're sure that they're always going to. So another person, that could be their habit. Then another person looks at that and says, oh, I was the best one in the second grade. I deserve to be in the class. They didn't let me. Okay, so here, you know, that person's story is, I didn't get what I deserved. And it plays out in all these different areas in your life. Okay? And somebody else could have looked at it as, I wanted to please my mom and dad by being in the second grade play, and the teacher didn't let me. And then, you know, what's my thing? Oh, I'm always trying to please my mom and dad, and I never got the opportunity to. Okay? And so that's their thing, how they're framing everything. You know, not everything, but a lot of things in their life. Okay? So it just takes one situation. But, you know, everybody picks out different data in that situation and interprets it in a certain way and makes a certain kind of story. And we'll find that certain stories that we just kind of, you know, put in that video, and it plays throughout various situations in our life. Okay? So, you know, the meditation itself, you know, sitting there on the cushion all those hours, you're going to start to see that. But then once you start to see that, what do you do with it? Okay? So, you know, what do you do with it? Because when the mind's so involved in making a story about it, it's hard to see if it's even a story. You just think it's reality. And so this is why the Lam Rim is so important. Okay? Is because when you notice those old memories or old patterns or whatever, you know, when there is an uncomfortable feeling in your mind, then that's a sign that there's delusion present. Okay? So when one of those memories comes up and you're not completely at ease with it, there's some feeling of discomfort somewhere, you know, the mind really wants to think about it some more, there's some, you know, delusion, you know, usually involved in that thing. Okay? And so what is it, and what's the antidote to it? Okay? You getting what I'm saying? And so then that's what you take the Lam Rim out, you know, okay, oh, this thing, I'm always feeling depressed. Oh, what's the Lam Rim antidote for depression? What do you meditate on?
Precious human life.
Yep, precious human life. Okay. Yeah, refuge, something like that. If you're sitting there and you're longing for what happened before and say, oh, it was so wonderful then, I just wish it would have lasted. Oh, I wonder if we can go back and, you know, pick it up with that person, you know. Then, okay, there's, what's the affliction present?
Attachment.
What's the antidote? Yeah, death and impermanence. or what if some incident comes up and you're going, oh my goodness, I am still so mad at my brother, sister, pet dog, whoever it was. I can't believe, you know, I was an innocent kid. Look what they did, and they got me all screwed up, and they did this and that. This is incredible, and I'm still mad about it all these years later. Okay, what's the affliction?
Anger.
What's the antidote?
Patience.
Okay, love, the bodhicitta meditations. Okay? So this is why you need Lama in here. Okay, so I just thought I'd go through a few of the verses each week, and then we'll have some Q&A that give us something to talk about. So I'm just going to dig in, because this is an informal session, so I'm not going to do the other preliminary stuff. Having gained this rare ship of freedom and fortune, hear, think, and meditate unwaveringly night and day in order to free yourself and others from the ocean cyclic existence. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. That is your motivation for the retreat. Mm-hmm. Okay, right there?
Can you read it?
Having gained the rare ship of freedom and fortune, in other words, of precious human life, hear, think, and meditate unwaveringly night and day. So what's the basic practice you have to do? You have to hear and learn teachings, then think about them, then put them into practice and meditate on them. Okay, why are you doing this? In order to free yourself and others from the ocean of cyclic existence. That's the reason why. Okay, so that's the reason, you know, why you're sitting in the meditation hall all these hours every day. Okay, that's the reason why you get out of bed every morning. Yeah? So if you're having a hard time waking up in the morning, memorize this verse and say it to yourself, you know, when you first hear the gong or the bell or something like this. Okay, so give yourself some oomph, you know, this is what I'm doing, this is what my mission is. This is my purpose. Okay. See if this one is ringing any bells in your meditation. Attached to your loved ones, you're stirred up like water. Anybody had that experience in their meditation? Only two people are raising their hands. Okay, how about hating your enemies? You burn like fire? Anybody having that one? A lot of people are lying. Only two hands went up from that. Who hasn't gotten angry in their meditation so far? You haven't gotten angry?
Not at others,
myself. Okay, but it still counts yourself. And check if there's some anger towards others too. Check. Really look. It's hard to get mad just at yourself. In the darkness of confusion, you forget what to adopt and discard. Anybody have that come up? Where am I in the sadhana? Oh, Vajrapani, Vajrapani, no, it's not Vajrapani, it's all Vajrasattva. Oh, Manikani, oh, now we're on the chair. Which one is it? She's a Kayamirawa. I'm a Vajrapani. Okay. So attached to loved ones, you're stirred up like water. Hating your enemies, you burn like fire. In the darkness of confusion, you forget what to adopt and discard. Story of my life. Okay? Give up your homeland. This is the practice of bodhisattva. Why does it say give up your homeland? Why doesn't he just say, just get rid of those thoughts? Mm-hmm. Why does it say give up your homeland?
Mm-hmm.
You have to make a break. With what? And why? You have to make a break with the patterns. And when you're in the same environment all the time, with the same people all the time, those patterns very easily keep rolling, don't they? Mm-hmm. Yeah? They just keep happening again and again and again. Because other people know us well, we know them well. Have you looked at some of your closest relationships and seen how there's kind of like a script you play out repeatedly with that person? Yeah? You've seen that? I mean, people have been together many, many years, or parents and children. There's a little kind of script you do all the time, you know? You know how to bug each other, you know how to press each other's buttons, you know how to look like you didn't. Okay? Yeah, so you just have this thing that just, because it's so habitual, and you don't even realize it. Yeah, you don't even realize it until you come into a retreat. How habitual, especially, you know, in certain key relationships where we're very close to somebody. Same old stuff, again and again and again. Okay? So, give up your homeland. What's the mind's usual reaction to that? No! I don't want to give up my homeland! I want to stay right where I am with the people that I love, in the environment that's familiar to me, with everything that I own, and where I know who I am, and it's all comfy. I don't want to give up my homeland. Right? Okay, this is why he says this is the practice of bodhisattvas, you know. I mean, just to kind of make an external change sometimes takes quite a bit for us. Yeah. It's really talking about making the internal change. But the external change is something that supports making the internal change. Because unless we're really, really strong, if we stay in the same environment, the patterns just keep happening again. Okay. So I'm not saying that everybody should, you know, move to the Abbey, and that those of you who are at the Abbey should now move away to the Abbey. Okay. The real thing is to, you know, change the patterns. But I think there's something to look at in the sense of really deciding that I need to change, you know. I really need, sometimes some drastic measures are necessary to start making that change happen. Okay? But just see what your situation is. Okay? By avoiding bad objects, disturbing emotions gradually decrease. Without distraction, virtuous activities naturally increase. With clarity of mind, conviction in the teaching arises. Cultivate seclusion. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay? So this verse is the opposite to the previous one. Okay, previous one was telling us what our problems are. Okay? And every time I read that verse, verse 2, it's like, whoa, you know, Thomas Uncle has me pegged. This is exactly it. And then, you know, then what do we do? What's the advantage of leaving our homeland, going to a Dharma environment? By avoiding bad objects, disturbing emotions gradually decrease. Okay? So bad objects, it doesn't mean the people that you love, you know, they're not bad objects. But it means whatever it is that makes your attachment, hatred, jealousy, arrogance, all these things arise. Okay? The things and the people from their side are not bad. Okay? They're called bad objects in the sense that our mind is so under their captivity that attachment, anger, and bewilderment just spin around and around whenever we're around those objects. Okay? So it's like, you know, the inmates who, you know, are getting ready to get released from prison. It's so important that they go into a new environment
and not be back with the old people and the old things and everything that was going on before, because that just stirs up the mind. But if they're in a new environment, and if they've made patterns in their mind, you know, through the time they've been incarcerated, of thinking in different ways, then by avoiding bad objects, and I think specifically intoxicants here, you know, for so many of the inmates, intoxicants is, you know, one of the major things. Intoxicants and friends who don't have good moral values, those are the two things. Okay, so by avoiding bad objects, disturbing emotions gradually decrease. Okay? If you're around people with good ethical discipline, if you're around people who don't drink and drug, okay, if you're around people who don't gossip, if you're having a problem with your speech, if you go around with your old friends who gossip and talk about this one and that one, your speech is going to be the same old way. If you remove yourself from that situation and you're with different people who talk in a different way, then you'll talk in a different way. This is one of the nice things I see when people come to the Abbey, is they find themselves behaving differently and they like themselves better. And I think part of it is because they're not with the quote-unquote bad objects, so the disturbing emotions gradually decrease because there's nothing to set it off. Okay. Of course, we can usually find something or another to set it off. Okay. Without distraction, virtuous activities naturally increase. Yeah? So if you're really trying to steer your mind in a virtuous way, if you're not having the distractions of, you know, what you usually have in your life, then your virtuous activities are naturally increasing. Okay? So, I mean, you're actually doing what this verse says. You're on retreat right now. That's the cultivating seclusion part. And you can see very well for yourself, okay, that you're not around the bad objects, so that the disturbing emotions are decreasing. Okay? Without distraction, your virtuous activities naturally increase. Easier to do a daily practice here, isn't it? Yeah? Could you do 6 sessions of meditation at home? You have a hard time doing 1 session of meditation at home, let alone 6. Here, flows so easily, doesn't it? You know, you're just in that hall and you're doing it. Yeah, you're doing 35 Buddhas. Yeah, because the environment just, you know, there's what else are you going to do? What, you know, without distraction. I mean, what are you going to distract yourself around with here? Yeah, I mean, you can only look at the snow melt off the ceiling, off the roof for so long, you know. And you can only look at the turkeys for so long. Yeah, so there's not a lot to get distracted by. Okay, with clarity of mind, conviction in the teaching arises. So do you find that happening on the retreat? Okay, that because you're really practicing and you're really looking at your own mind and the teachings are coming into your mind as you're looking at your mind, that your conviction in what the Buddha said is growing. So you can see he really knew what he was talking about. Okay. So, you know, these are the things that are the total antidote to the second verse. Okay. How do you get them? Cultivate seclusion. So it really means, seclusion here really means seclusion in terms of, it doesn't mean like staying in a room with, you know, all by yourself. It means that you're secluded from things that set your mind off. Yeah, you're secluded from having lots of sense distraction around you. Okay, because when there's a lot of sense things, yeah, we get so distracted, and it's very difficult to focus and concentrate. And I think we actually get exhausted. I mean, one of my theories is that one of the reasons that we sleep is not because the body's tired, but because the mind is tired of having to deal so much with sense objects. I mean, think about it. When you go to sleep, how often do the muscles in your body feel tired? Yeah? How often is it that your body is physically tired? Yeah. Or is it just a feeling of tiredness around your eyes? Or is it mostly that the mind just wants a break from, like, all this stuff that's in your face all the time? Yeah. So there's a certain way that the mind quiets down and we don't have a lot of the sense distractions. Okay. That's what we'll do this week. Okay. So now, your questions and what's happening with you in your meditation. Yeah.
Okay, confession time.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a dream yesterday night, mm-hmm. and was excited about this, but very clear because I was thinking, we've been here for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And nothing really extraordinary had happened, you know. The meditation has been okay, I've been following the landing guides and thinking a lot. But because I have previous experiences with purification, with, you know, dead things coming out, and
mm-hmm.
so I was expecting more, you know. So I was thinking, something is not working. Maybe it's the mantra, okay, I'm saying it too fast. And actually, I noticed that there were a couple of syllables missing. So yesterday I was struggling with the mantra to put the syllable back, you know, in its place. It wouldn't stick. So it was kind of worried. But I knew that there was something else, and it was clear. But it was clear, but it was not clear. So I went to bed, and I had this dream that was really shocking.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I have gone somewhere. In the dream it was Canada. Okay? And I have taken a plane and flew away, very far away. And I was working there with some guy who is a friend from my past, 20 years ago. And we were polishing a Buddha statue, a white Buddha statue. And we were cleaning it. But for some reason, my family kept bringing me back home. You know, so they were taking me back home, and it was happening many times. And I was back home with my mom and dad and my brothers, and it was okay. It was very comfortable, very nice. But I kept thinking, this is ridiculous. I was over there, you know, thousands of miles away, polishing my Buddha statue, and I'm coming back home with my family. So. Then I was back in this place with my Buddha statue, and I had a bucket of, it was supposed to be white milk, so, but the nectar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I was seeing the nectar, and it was all watered down. It was just water, not white stuff, you know. The white stuff was on the bottom, just like, you know, clock.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave it to my friend, and we were like, supposed to clean the Buddha statue with this, but it wouldn't work because it was just water, and it was dirty also. There was some stuff, you know, floating around, dirt. So you were saying, this is not me. We can't do anything with this. You look at this. It's filthy. So I woke up saying, because that's what was in my mind, you know. So my conclusion, and I think it was very clear, because first I thought, yeah, my family, they were guilty of everything. You know? And I said, this is not my family. You know, these are my habitual patterns and everything that is familiar to me. You know, so I'm here very far away trying to stay with my white Buddha, you know, cleaning it and everything. And I keep going back to the same place, you know, my habitual patterns of behavior and liking things and disliking things and wanting to be liked by people and this and that. And so my nectar is watered down, you know, it's not really working. So my conclusion was very strong for me because, well, one thing that is very clear, and it has been clear for years, but I never wanted to really take the steps to work on that, is that you can have the cake and eat it. Is mm-hmm. either, if you really want to purifying the negativities and everything, you really have to give up your from your parents. You know, you can't go back all the time and have a good time and just relax and the nectar will do everything for you. You really have to do the work. So you're very sorry. And it's actually, for me, it's very revealing and it's painful.
Yeah.
Because the spiritual path was supposed to be very smooth and very nice, you know, like very, I will do what I want to do. And now I can see that I don't want to be God. Like, it feels good, you know, to be these objects of attachment that are appearing all the time, very nice and very appealing. Is all the happiness I know.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. So to take that decision that portrayed seclusion to say no more, it's no easy. Not easy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's what happened.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Very good.
Can I say something about this? My experience about the homeland and habits, and familiar habits, city, the same city, is I find very difficult to get rid of the habits you got when you were a kid and you were very conditionable.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, I lived in Japan for about 7 years, and when I was going back to Mexico, I thought I had changed very, very much. I thought I could do everything different and I could relate to my father, my brothers, everybody, very different. And the surprise for me, after 7 years in Japan, going back and thinking I had changed, is that the habits are so strong when you go back into your homeland that after some time, on the one hand, you start getting again the passion,
mm-hmm.
but your family and people try to that you are the same person.
Right.
They want to be the same.
Yeah.
So the two energies
right.
get together.
Right.
And after a while, I got back completely, and I have worse problems maybe.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say this because it's very strong, very difficult to get rid of this habit.
Yes.
So you really have to work as but it's very, very hard. And the question I have is, well, I thought I had to go back to work with this kind of problem, to work with my relationship with my father and my brothers and everybody. And I thought, well, it's going to be worth it. But at the same time, I think I lost the battle anyway, because I got back again to...
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you said is quite true, that we have our patterns, but our family, you know, what I was saying before about the patterns of relationships, they have their patterns of relating to us, and they're not really keen for us to change either, you know? Yeah, I mean, because everybody kind of knows how everybody else is, and even if you fight all the time, it's still familiar. Yeah? And I think that's one of the hardest things when we're trying to change is to when we start doing things differently, and then the people are shocked and they don't know how to handle us. Yeah. But wait a minute, you. Wait, this is the script we play out all the time. How can you not say this when I say that? Yeah. But it's, and you know, it happens in anger scripts, attachment scripts, the, you know, competition scripts. Yeah. And it's jarring sometimes for the other people in our lives too. Yeah. Who see us as permanent and fixed with a very rigid, concrete eye. Yeah. Yeah. That's why being in a different environment, like when you come here, yeah, you don't even necessarily know everybody who's here. So you have the space to be a different person. You don't have to be who you were before. Yeah, there's space to be different here. Other questions?
Yes? The question is that the last week, mm-hmm. you were saying something to John about the levels of things, emotion and other things.
Uh-huh.
And you said something about that we, in order to develop mindfulness, mm-hmm. we should pay attention to our body.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and my question is that when you meditate last week, like you open your eyes, like, you know? And I didn't know what exactly you mean. By now I know what you mean. So it was so like a dozen of eyes, like opening up and an awareness and expressionness. And it was, well, you know what I mean. My question is this. Are we supposed to feel the same with the lamb ring, for example? If we think about love and compassion, mm-hmm. that awareness is going to, in order to get to know really that, to feel that sensation too? Or it is going to be just intellectual wonder?
Oh, okay. So you're asking like when you're doing the lamb ring meditations. For example, you're saying trying to develop love and compassion. Are you just intellectually going through the points, or are you really aiming to feel it? Is that your question?
My question is that I have done this with intellectual concepts, ideas, thoughts.
Right.
And you feel. You feel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you cry.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Mm-hmm.
But that's enough. Or we have to be able to feel the another thing that completely awareness. For example, I was thinking, let's see if I could explain myself. I was meditating. And suddenly, I just opened my eyes, and it was like a dozen of eyes opening. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That and the other feeling. That are we supposed to feel when we think of love and compassion and lamb ring? Or another way?
I'm not sure if I know what you mean, but don't have an idea of an outcome you're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Don't have, I've got to feel, and then I'll know I've gotten it. Because that's focusing on the result. Yeah. Just do the meditation.
The way I'm doing.
Just do the meditation mm-hmm. and let happen what happens. But if you're trying to say, okay, unless I meditate on Lama and I'm thinking about the kindness of all these suffering sentient beings and they've done so much to me, and unless I cry at the end of the meditation because I have so much compassion for them, then my meditation is a failure.
Okay, yeah.
No, don't think like that. Don't think like that, because then what you're trying to do is you're not going to feel anything spontaneously or naturally because you have some kind of rigid idea about what you think you're supposed to feel. Instead, just create the causes. Just contemplate, you know, the first two noble truths in relationship to sentient beings. Yeah, contemplate the three kinds of sufferings that they experience. Contemplate how they're under the influence of ignorance and attachment, even though they want to be happy. Think about that, you know, and think about it in relationship to people you know and people you don't know, people you like, people you don't like. And then, whatever you feel, that's fine. Okay? But if you're trying to make yourself feel something and judging your meditation, you're blocking yourself.
Yes, because I was thinking, maybe I have done the lamb ring in that way that you are describing.
Uh-huh.
But now when I feel that, I said, maybe I haven't understood anything. I was just wondering if I have done the vaccine or not.
You know, it takes us a while to actually learn what meditating and lamb ring means. Because I know for me, for quite a long time, you know, I just went through 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, 1, 2, 3, about that, or yeah, I'm supposed to feel that. Well, yeah, I kind of do, but not completely. What's next? Okay, and that's why I think the real trick is using those, you know, making those meditations quite personal. Yeah, and using them, putting our life really into them. Yeah. So it's not just, oh yeah, I'm not, like, start with precious human life. It's not just, yeah, I'm not going to hell, I'm not going. What's the next one? Predators, I'm not born there, I'm not born in the animal realm, I'm not born. Yeah, long live God. I don't know if I believe in those guys anyway, but anyway, I'm not born this one. You know, that's not the way to do it. But imagine, you know, okay, what would it be like if I were in a situation of extreme pain? Could I practice the Dharma? What would happen to my mind in a situation of extreme pain? Well, knowing my mind, I usually freak out. Totally uncontrollable. Can't do anything useful with my mind. Whoa, thank goodness I'm not in that situation. Okay? Yeah? So you do it, you make it really personal. Yeah, are you meditating on karma? Karma's, you know, first point, you know, karma's definite, that happiness comes from virtue and unhappiness comes from misery. Do I really believe that? Well, yeah, I believe it. Do I live like I believe it? Then you start looking at your actions. Do you really live like you believe that happiness comes from positive actions and negative and unhappiness comes from negative actions? Do I really live my life like that? No, I live my life like, you know, that second helping of food and that next movie is going to make me happy. Right now. That's the cause of my happiness. That's how I live. You know. And I live my life that, yeah, if I have to tell a little white lie kind of here to negotiate that, that's the cause of happiness. Okay? So you make it very personal. Okay?
Mm-hmm. A bit simplistic, but going through an attachment, you know, just trying to go through it like using the Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm.
For example, this coffee. Okay, I drank coffee, the suffering of no more coffee. Okay? And so that's the gross sense level dukkha first truth, right?
Yeah.
The truth of it. And the second, you know, the second is the cause of it is craving. So I don't have a problem with the coffee anymore, but there's this routine that goes with it. Get up early, I get 20 minutes to read Dharma, and you know, it's like, and then I said, well, wait a minute. You know, I cut off the gross level, but I still have the cost, still craving, not the coffee, but the, it's bigger than just the coffee.
What are you craving?
I got
tea
now. Uh-huh. And then I go, okay, well, let's just put that whole back. And so am I going to see some sensation of this? And do I have to go through the whole fourth truth, you know, to evaluate that whole craving? And I don't know how to work with that.
Okay. So you're not missing the coffee so much now. What are you craving?
Well, it's just, I see that, okay, I still have the same routine. I just replaced the coffee with tea.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Okay. Now, is there anything inherently non-virtuous about reading the Dharma and drinking a cup of tea?
No, but there's an attachment to it, or it feels that way.
Isn't it attachment? Is an attachment the same way as when the mind says, I really need this, grasping at something else outside of you? Is it that kind of attachment?
It certainly doesn't have the buzz.
Or is it just like a habit that you're in that you do to kind of wake yourself up in the morning?
Right.
Okay.
That's all it really is.
Yeah. Then,
so I'm...
There are worse things going on. Don't. Yeah, sure about that one.
Yeah. I understand.
Yeah. You know, it's you. We have to really learn to discriminate, kind of, what's attachment and what's a habit and what's liking something. You know, what's craving and what's wanting. We have to learn to discriminate these things. Okay, what's aspiration? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because just being attracted towards something doesn't necessarily mean that you're craving and clinging it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We can be attracted to the Dharma teachings. Yeah? So don't confuse attraction with craving and clinging. Now, sure, in some cases, attraction is the predecessor and gives birth to craving and clinging. Okay? I'm attracted to that chocolate cake. Womp! Okay? Yeah, so there, you know, there's some attachment going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if it's just something that you know, you're sitting and drinking a cup of tea and reading a Dharma book, and you're getting some good imprints, and it's a calming way to start your day. Don't call that craving and attachment. Think, well, I better go and turn on the television set first thing in the morning to prove to myself I'm not attached to reading my Dharma book.
Okay, so
no, don't.
If it comes out confusing to me, then I can just apply the discernment. I mean,
you need to discern what exactly is craving,
okay?
And what is aspiration? Because many people, you know, get this confused. They think anytime you aspire for something, that it's clinging,
right.
Okay? Yeah. You aspire for Buddhahood. We're trying to create that aspiration. That's not clinging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? We aspire to end suffering. We aspire to generate love and compassion in our hearts. We should generate those aspirations as much as possible. Don't think that everything you're attracted or aspiring for is attachment, because then the only image you have yourself of a Buddhist is somebody who's sitting there going, duh. You know, because they're not attracted to anything. They don't aspire for anything. I accept everything. Duh. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at His Holiness Dalai Lama. I mean, he's active. He knows exactly what he wants. Yeah? I mean, because I got in this confusion too at the beginning. Oh, if I have any kind of preference for this or that, then it's just attachment. You know? Okay, well, if I have preference for, you know, I want to live at the seashore and I, you know, in a condo rather than, you know, in the inner city, yeah, that's some attachment to sense pleasure. Okay? But if I have the preference that I'd much rather spend this time reading a Dharma book or talking with a Dharma friend than, you know, listening to music with an old friend, that's no attachment. That's something virtuous that you're trying to get your mind to want and be attracted towards. Okay? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So really, you know, remember that with attachment, we have to really know what the definition of attachment is. It's not just attraction to something. And it's not just wanting something. That's not the definition of attachment. Attachment is based upon a mind that exaggerates the good qualities of someone or something, or projects good qualities that aren't there, then clinging and wanting, not wanting to be separate from it. Okay? Yeah? So, if you're sitting there, you know, oh, I really want to be with this person, that's attachment. Okay? But it's like, oh, I would really like to have a stable mind, and I aspire to develop some more mindfulness and calmness in my mind. You know, I aspire to have some interest in reading Dharma first thing in the morning. Yeah, oh, what a great aspiration, you know, to be attracted to Dharma first thing in the morning. Go for it. Yeah? Yeah, make this guy a cup of tea tomorrow morning, will you? All of you get up and, you know. And because we all have our little routines in the morning, don't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we always, some people say, oh, I don't like rituals. Oh, our life is filled with rituals. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our little morning routine of how we get up. Well, how wonderful that you put Dharma in your morning routine. Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people don't have Dharma in their morning routine. You know, they wake up and the news is blaring and, you know, they get out of bed and they see a stack of bills and, you know. That's very good. I'm glad you asked that. That's real important. I think it's distinctive. Hmm? It's very helpful to, I think there should be some tapes on the mind and mental factors downstairs, and listen to them, because it, you know, it goes through some of the positive mental factors. They are ones that we want to cultivate, and then what the negative ones are.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very helpful, you know, because admiration, okay, for virtuous things is a mental factor we want to cultivate. You know, aspiration for positive things. You know, conviction in the teachings. Yeah, all these are the things. And they're involved with attraction.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no exaggeration. Yeah? And you're not projecting things. Yeah? Okay.